I've had a number of your folks come on over the last couple of years, and my perception of a community college has significantly changed from the days when I went to college.
Sure.
And the choices that people make today and the options that community colleges offer has also changed that perception as well. But back in the day, this is in the 80s and 70s, the community college was the place that people went to if they A, didn't make a four-year college, or they couldn't afford a four-year college, or they needed to kind of regrade themselves because they didn't really take advantage of their high school opportunities, and this was a purgatory, if you will, to show yourself and then move on. That's historical. That's 30 years ago. And not anything close to Raritan Valley Community College today. Now I go over there and I see that it's becoming even a value choice, a very good value choice for students to go. You guys, the Raritan Valley Community College especially, but a lot of the community colleges now have the agreements with the four-year colleges where you get your education 2 years in Raritan Valley and then you move on to the 4 years potentially. So with that complete shift of the way a Raritan Valley Community College and community colleges in general has created this opportunity, why did you see that you needed a special niche of group of students that you needed to take care of in that environment? What does that group of students need that they weren't getting when they were showing up in the early 2000s? I know it's a long question.
Well, I think, like I said, part of it was that the high-achieving students were always coming to Raritan, and they were having to kind of run their own race and plot their own course, and we wanted to provide additional support services and provide some structure that would allow foster an environment where all high-achieving students were taking the same classes together so that as far as their expectations individually, feeding off of an environment where everybody had big goals and big dreams, and not having to wonder, if I have a lab assignment and we're a partner, am I going to have to do all the work? is it okay that I want to go to an Ivy League school? Yeah, of course, it's great because everybody in that honors program may not have the exact same school as a destination, but they have the exact same goals. They hold themselves to a high standard.
Sure.
And putting students like that in that same environment, one, it's great educational
setting.
Practice.
Yeah.
But it's a promotional for the college. It shows the quality of the work that our faculty and staff have done for decades.
Right.
But it also put students in a more advantageous position because past success paves the way for future success, as it is with many things in life. And those first couple of years where we were, as an honors college, trying to get the word out, trying to get guidance counselors and schools to buy into the premise of we're a first-choice school, not a backup plan.
Well, that's apparently – that's come out loud and clear over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Well,
that's true, and that's not reserved solely for the Honors College. That's in general because there was always a misconception that if you go to a community college, you're somehow deferring your dreams or closing doors on options.
Right.
But the reality is you're giving yourself more options as a result, because you're putting yourself in a better position academically.
And financially.
And you have greater clarity in what you want to do with your life.
Yep.
And you know yourself better, so you're not transferring to a school that you might have gone to out of high school because of peer pressure or because that's where my friends went or that's because where my parents want me to go.
Mm-hmm.
You're now picking schools because of who you are. You've maybe changed your major and gained greater clarity on what you want to study.
Yep.
Sure, you've saved some money. You've gotten high-level academics.
Yep.
You've gotten a chance to be involved on campus because perhaps at a big school when you go away, you don't hit your stride on a personal level until maybe your junior or senior year where you feel like, okay, now I want to be a leader. I want to be a voice on campus.
Right.
At Raritan Valley, you get started from day one. So when you transfer as a junior after finishing your associate's degree at Raritan, your leadership skills are much more enhanced than perhaps a student who spent their first 2 years kind of just trying to figure out how their big four-year college works.
Yep.
those Raritan students are coming in as juniors, confident, academically prepared, and have already experienced success that comes with, you know, leadership and the confidence that you gain as a result of seeing something you've been a part of grow. Mm-hmm. And those are things that aren't apparent
yep.
at the beginning, but as you continue evolving throughout your Raritan experience, are what they look back most fondly on when they graduate are the experiences they had and the you know, understanding that those experiences may not even been available at a four-year school had they chose to go there.
Sure. Now, the since you said the first one you opened was 17 students.
Yes.
I still got so many questions. Okay, so they're obviously not all studying the same.
Not the same major.
Major. Yeah. So how did you get them to be cohorts, but yet they're so diverse sure. in their direction?
Well, what we did was when we designed the curriculum, we identified core general education courses that were applicable to all majors.
Okay.
So to clarify, every student in the Honors College is not taking the exact same 20, 21 courses needed for their associate's degree. They're taking usually about 8 or so honors classes, and we've identified classes that are common to every major, such as English 1, English 2, a math, a psychology, classes that every major needs in some form. And so, therefore, students are getting the best of both worlds. You could be a business major, an engineering major, an English major, and all be in the Honors College because you're taking your non-major classes as part of your Honors College cohort,
mm-hmm.
and then you're taking your major-specific classes with those similar students who are interested in business, engineering, or English.
Right.
So, you're getting the best of both worlds. You're not in a little bubble where it's just the 25 or 30 honors students, and then you're all together and you never interact with the rest of the college.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting a varied experience because you're getting honors classes with your other honors classmates, but then you're also taking engineering or business or any major with those other students who have the same career pursuits as you.
Okay. So you're getting – it's two different environments, but it's giving you a diverse perspective.
Correct. So,
nice.
So the gen ed classes, that core that every student needs, those are the honors classes, and that allows us to offer the honors experience to any student pursuing an associate's degree. It's not major specific.
When you guys released this, did you think you were acquiring another group of students that you had not reached before, or did you simply replace students that you normally would have had on campus and just give them a better opportunity?
I think initially, until our visibility rose and until our success started being evident, we were probably attracting many of the students that we would have gotten already,
mm-hmm.
but we were collecting them and bringing them together as part of a learning community and a cohort. But I would say as we've evolved over the last few years, now, like I said, we're heading into our sixth year, I know for a fact because as we have to interview the students. That's part of our application process because for the Honors College, the application process is different than the regular RVCC admissions process.
Right.
Good afternoon. It's a few minutes after 4 o'clock. Beautiful day out there. My name is Pat Smits, and I'll be talking to you about some of the legal cases and legal news. But before I start, I just wanted to give you an update on the weather on this beautiful day, September 23rd, 2006, almost the end of the month already. But today, sunny with a high of near 89 degrees. So tonight will be slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Probably not, but there could be some before about 11 o'clock. Tomorrow, it says it'll be mostly cloudy, but if we take the prediction from last week where it was supposed to be raining on Sunday, it really didn't happen in most of our area. But tomorrow should be mostly cloudy. High of near 73 degrees. By Sunday, it's sunny, but high only about 69 degrees. By Monday, again, mostly sunny, high near 70. And Tuesday, there is a chance of showers during the day, but then partly sunny, high near 73 degrees. It looks like there's a possibility of rain on the weekend, although there's still not sure about that yet, and we shall see. But the other thing I wanted to let you know is that there is going to be next Saturday, October 1st, there's going to be what we call the Hunterdon County World Music Day, and it's from 10 a.m. until 5 p.m. at Deer Path Park. If you've not been to Deer Path Park, it's really a great place. It's on Woodschuck Road, north on 31, north of Flemington, and there's going to be picnics, and so you can certainly bring your chairs and blankets. There are going to be jam sessions, Irish music, bluegrass music, African music, and actually they're inviting people to bring their own instrument if you want to play, and you won't have to store it in your hot car because they will have storage available. Free admission, which is always nice, and free parking, and it's going to be presented by the Hunterdon County Cultural and Heritage Commission and co-sponsored by the Hunterdon County Division of Parks and Recreation. Obviously, you'll have to keep a lookout as to whether or not there would be any problems with the weather, because I'm sure that if that happens, since this is outside, they would definitely have to change the date. I don't see that there is a rain date at this time, but hopefully it won't rain. There's going to even be someone with a Native American flute playing, which is really, it's haunting. It's really haunting if anyone knows how to play the Native American flute well. And there are going to be many other instruments, as I said, Irish, bluegrass, African. Should be a lot of interesting music. Fun, kids can run around. I think there's some things, especially for children also. So let's go out and celebrate and appreciate what we have here in Hunterdon County. So what else is happening? Well, let me tell you a little bit about some spots from our sponsors, and then I'll be back to talk about the news, meaning the legal news.
Good morning, Hunterdon. This is Big C coming to you from HunterdonChamberRadio.com at the studio offices of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce in Flemington, New Jersey. Good morning, Hunterdon kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic, and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Hunterdon County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Hunterdon, HunterdonChamberRadio.com.
Lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. Let me repeat, lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. This is not a crazy diet or exercise program. No drugs, hormones, or shots. You can lose 20 to 45 pounds in 40 days with Nutrimost Resonant Frequency Technology to measure 2,800 of your body's key biomarkers. Using NRF, they can find and correct the cause of your weight problem by measuring factors affecting weight gain, including metabolism, fat burning, fat storage, appetite, detoxification, and hormonal regulation. It's safe, fast, easy, and effective, and you won't walk around hungry or have cravings. It's even doctor supervised. Schedule a body composition analysis and consultation. You can be transformed in 40 days guaranteed. This is a limited time offer, so they can't wait to see you look great.
So call 888-718-7077. That's 888-718-7077. Or visit njthin.com. That's njthin.com.
Let Stowaway Self-Storage be your local moving and storage solution. With three great locations in Hunterdon County, Stowaway is conveniently located in Flemington, White House, and Lebanon. Stowaway Self-Storage offers sizes from 5x5 to 50x50, discounted packing supplies, and U-Haul rentals on site.
affordable monthly rentals for your personal and business use, let Stowaway help you park your car in the garage again or store those old records that you need to keep. Visit us at stowawayselfstorage.com and mention this ad to receive 50% off your first month's rent.
Well, good afternoon. Back. I'm Pat Smith's program, It's the Law, and talk about some of the things that is happening, some of the things that are happening around the state and some of the cases. One of the things that everyone should be very concerned about is the fact that we still have so many judicial vacancies. It really creates problems when judicial vacancies are not filled. It means that justice is delayed. It takes longer. Everything is more expensive. It's frustrating both for the attorneys, the judges, and, of course, the litigants. For example, the vacancy rate, the highest vacancy rate is, or at least one of the highest vacancy rates, maybe the highest, is in Mercer County, where there are 15 allotted judicial positions and 7 vacancies. I mean, that's just unbelievable. No one, there's no way that they can handle all of the cases if that happens, especially because there are certain cases that have to take precedence, including the criminal cases, including children in courts, meaning the children where there's abuse, neglect, and termination of parental rights. Many of these cases, they have to be heard, they have to be dealt with, and so what happens is that the civil cases, the family cases, everything is put on the back burner. And believe me, as an attorney who's been in practice many years, when cases take that long to get to trial, or even any reasonable thought that there's going to be pressure for trial, it just doesn't work. There's a New Jersey physician in the news. He was not happy because although a former patient unfair comments to say the very least, and the physician received a $65,000 judgment compensatory and punitive damages because of the defamation suit, the appellate court ruled that they just decided that they cut the damages and took it away. So after all of that, he's still faced with whatever the patient was saying, which was defamatory, but permitted. Of course, there's wide latitude with respect to free speech, and so this is always the problem, especially out on the internet, because people can be really damaged, their reputations can be damaged unfairly. We have Marsh USA, Inc. That's the insurance broker, and that's a broker at the heart of a multi-district antitrust litigation, and now they have to face claims that the company conspired with carriers to artificially inflate prices, and that was the ruling of a New Jersey federal judge. This is federal legislation, not state legislation. Now, as I said, the defamation suit, although it was not approved for publication, the defendant in that suit appealed from an order denying his motion for reconsideration of a judgment entered in favor of the plaintiff, a physician by the name of Frank Sciascia. And the plaintiff was a licensed physician, board certified, and defendant was one of the physician's patients, and he performed a rhinoplasty procedure on defendant's nose as well as a chin augmentation. And after the recovery period, defendant returned to plaintiff's office and stated that he had injured one of the bones in his nose and had tried to manipulate it to correct it by sticking chopsticks and hairpins inside his nose. So at that point, the doctor examined the defendant and found that the defendant had not damaged his nose. Apparently, the defendant never returned to the doctor's office, and subsequently, the doctor noticed that an individual was posting derogatory comments about him onto internet websites. And apparently these are websites www.doctordecision.com, and the other one is www.ripoffreport.com. And so what happened is the doctor learned that it was the defendant, who was the individual who had made these remarks, after defendant posted similar comments concerning him on a third website. Apparently that one, and if you didn't know, there seems to be websites for everything. This one is www.liposuction4u.com. So in that case, the defendant had uploaded his own photograph to that website. So that's how the doctor found out about it. He also put in his comments, of course, and according to the doctor, many prospective plaintiffs use the internet to choose their physician, and people put a lot of trust into these online reviews. And in fact, that's probably an accurate statement. Now, why anyone would ever really put anything or believe anything on the internet is pretty amazing without checking out the source. I've certainly seen things on the internet where there are quotes, things are taken out of context. You have to be very, very careful. So in any event, the plaintiff was concerned when a patient entered his name in an internet search engine that the plaintiff would see a defendant's comments and choose another doctor. In this case, the judge awarded the plaintiff $25,000 in actual and presumed damages. And the judge also granted plaintiff $40,000 in punitive damages. So what happened is the appellate panel affirmed the judgment. However, because the plaintiff failed to demonstrate actual harm to his reputation by competent evidence, the panel reversed the trial judge's award of $25,000 in actual or compensatory damages. And they remanded the case to the judge to consider whether the plaintiff was entitled to nominal damages under the presumed damages doctrine. And they also, the panel also reversed the judge's award of punitive damages. So this case shows that, you know, there's something going on the internet. It would be very, very difficult for a plaintiff in these circumstances to prove that a patient did not use him based on what was seen on the internet. I suppose if he'd had three or four patients that had initially consulted him for procedures and then said that they were not going to use him because of these negative derogatory comments on the internet, perhaps there would have been some nexus of proof. But that's going to be an extremely difficult burden. And so that's where, you know, people feel that they can, in fact, do whatever and say whatever they want. And there really are some, you know, derogatory comments, untrue comments out there. Now, of course, the only thing that the defendant had to do, obviously, unless he represented himself, and I don't think he did, is, you know, he had to pay the legal fees to defend against the initial suit and then take it up on appeal. So perhaps there's something in that that would try to keep some people from, you know, making such derogatory comments. But there's nothing to, this is going to be really difficult to prove. And that's the problem. Often evidence is just not the kind of evidence that someone needs to prove something. There's the Delaware Riverkeeper Network and a number of other environmental groups in 35 states are demanding a congressional investigation of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, alleging its abuses that it is abusing its power under the Natural Gas Act by stripping states of their and not only the states but residents in states of legal rights and ignoring the federal mandates and inflicting environmental harm, all in the interest of the energy industry. So there's always that fight, and now the scores of these groups are demanding a congressional investigation. So what else is happening? The charges amount as charges amount against this alleged bomber Ahmad Khan Ramami in connection with the bombings in Manhattan and New Jersey. One thing could make the job more difficult and complicated for the prosecutors and defense attorneys. And apparently, what's happened, of course, is that the charges have been brought against the defendant in three different jurisdictions. So the question will be, you know, which jurisdiction should take the lead in this, whether it's New Jersey, New York, or federal. So that'll be something that, you know, could make things more complicated. Now, I don't even want to, you know, go into the comment, but I guess we've all heard about the Brangelina split, and if in fact that goes through, has all of the hallmarks of a high-profile celebrity split, because, you know, certainly the children, the parties have six children under the age of 18. You know, let's hope that they do things, you know, quietly if, in fact, this divorce goes through so they can spare the children any more headlines. But in any event, people don't always do that, and certainly celebrities don't always do that. One of the things that we did have, though, is the way Katie Holmes handled the case when she decided to divorce Tom Cruise. And that was handled with dignity. In fact, one of the attorneys here in New Jersey, a friend of mine, was involved in that settlement. And so that people can do these things quietly. And, of course, you know, whether or not this case, whether or not they really do get divorced is, you know, maybe yes, maybe no, time will tell. But certainly let's hope they can do it in a way that will spare their children to the extent possible. One of the, what about us, now we go from that to self-driving vehicles, and apparently guidelines are welcomed by the regulators and manufacturers. And so the not only the state regulators, but industry attorneys and vehicle manufacturers greeted the federal automated vehicles policy as a positive step towards providing clarity and preventing an undesirable patchwork of local laws. I mean, this is one of the things that, you know, is a real problem when you have conflicting laws in different states. And so that there are times where it makes sense to have federal statutes and other times, of course, where the state should be the only entity that regulates certain things. There was a case reported this week, a criminal case, where an appeal was a reported decision. I've talked to you before about reported decisions and the fact that decisions that are reported, approved for publication, set a precedent. And this one is the appellate division case. And it was an appeal from a conviction for possession of marijuana with intent to distribute. And so in that case, the appellate division addressed the question of whether the holding in another case, State v. Kane, should be applied retroactively to cases still pending on appeal. And so the appellate division said, based on their review of the language used by the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decision was the decision in State v. Kane. That was a 2016 decision. If anyone's interested, it's located at 224NJ410. But the appellate division said, based on the language used by the Supreme Court in that case, and also in another case, State v. Sims, also a Supreme Court case, and other what they call post-Odom decisions, they concluded that Cain's holding must be given pipeline retroactivity and applied to all cases pending on a direct appeal. So when they mean pipeline, it means all cases that had been filed and were on appeal. So that's pretty significant because it means basically that there's, you know, it's retroactive from the standpoint of, you know, the case, the Supreme Court case came out in 2016, and it's going to apply to all of those cases that were not finalized before the Supreme Court case. So that if an appeal had been decided before the 2016 decision by the Supreme Court, it would be ended, and that would be the prior law. But now anything that's on appeal, the New Jersey Supreme Court rulings will apply. Things that attorneys look for, not necessarily other people, but except criminals. So if there's something that comes out that's favorable to them, of course they want it to apply. But if it's not favorable, they certainly don't want it to apply. So there was a trust in estates case, and too bad John Manfreda's not here because I'd like to talk to him about what his view is. But in this case, the plaintiffs, meaning the people who filed the suit, were the decedent's former wife and his two children. So they filed the case alleging that the decedent intentionally and wrongfully rendered his estate insolvent through what we call inter vivos transfers, meaning lifetime transfers to the individually named defendants, and that those defendants knew of and cooperated with his plan. So the plaintiffs, remember the decedent's former wife and his children, asserted claims for breach of the property settlement agreement between the decedent and his former wife. So what happens is, in fact, if people have a property settlement agreement, that controls. But in this case, the property settlement agreement required the decedent to maintain $100,000 life insurance for the benefit of his former wife. And so they claim that, you know, it was required by contract, and what they said is it was intentional interference of a contract and a violation of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. And so the decedent's daughter appealed the trial court's order dismissing all but the count concerning the life insurance policy and its January 2nd, 2015 order denying plaintiff's post-judgment relief. So this was up in the appellate division. So finding numerous discrete issues that were not specifically addressed in the trial court's oral ruling and noting the complexity of these issues and the court's general obligation to examine the record on summary judgment in light most favorable to the non-moving party, the appellate division vacated the summary judgment, dismissing plaintiff's claims, and remanded the substantive issues to the trial court for further consideration. So that is, you know, I don't have a decision as to why the trial court in this case did not uphold the terms of the property settlement agreement, but in fact the appellate division sent it back. And so that's significant because it's, without reading the entire reasoning of the trial judge, it's hard to understand why the trial judge would not have upheld the terms of the property settlement agreement. So that would be, but it's going back, and it will probably go back to the same judge. I mean, most of the time, unless the court says differently, in fact, it does go back to the judge who tried the case. But this this is a case who that would be in the Chancery Division, not in the Family Division. So it would, you know, be an interesting case to follow up as to if, in fact, we knew why the trial judge, exactly why the trial judge did what he or she did. And we know that there was no written decision, but apparently an oral opinion. And the oral opinion basically said to the plaintiffs, you don't have a case. So we'll be, I want to let you know about some of our other sponsors, and then we'll be back for the rest of the program.
Hey, this is Big C of Good Morning Hunterdon on HuntingChamberRadio.com. Like what you hear on Hunting Chamber Radio? Now you can take it with you. Download our Hunting Chamber Radio app from iTunes and Google Play Store now. Get schedules, station information, listen live, or to the latest podcasts. Everything in the palm of your hand or in your car during your commute. Get the HuntingChamberRadio.com app today.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals.
Call Home Instead Senior Care. It's our passionate dedication to creating personal relationships between our clients and our caregivers. Visit our website at www.homeinstead.com/325.
Whoops, okay, we're back. It's the law, and just wanted to follow up on a couple other things that have been in the news, and one is that our U.S. Senator Cory Booker attempted to bring up the confirmation of a New Jersey federal judge nominee, and it's been languishing. I can't even remember when this was first brought up, but Julian Neils, you know, the senator tried to, you know, get a vote on this, and, you know, he tried to bring it up, and a proposal was derailed by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And the problem with all of this is that things have become so political that we can't, or whoever is trying to bring up somebody for vote, they can't even do that. So vote up or down, but at least allow these judges and even the Supreme Court nominee vote, because otherwise it just, we have so many judicial vacancies at the federal level, and it takes so long, and it's so political. In New Jersey, we have the same problem for a different reason. And we have so many judicial vacancies, for example, Mercer County, that I talked about a little bit earlier. I mean, it's outrageous that there are 7 vacancies in a bench that has 15 slots for judges. I mean, it's difficult enough if there's 1 or 2 vacancies out of 15. But 7 makes it just impossible to get anything done. So the a federal judge has ordered a former general counsel for Lennox Corporation to permit third-party inspection of his computer hard drive in connection with the company's suit claiming he sabotaged the acquisition of a competing company. And so he was trying to block his computer, and they said nope. And so whether or not this leads to anything, but the allegations is that he was trying to sabotage the acquisition of a competing company. And obviously he was fired, and there's litigation, and they're trying to meaning Lennox, is trying to defend against what they did. now the Third Circus. It is Friday, guys. Remember, the Third Circuit. That's the federal Third Circuit here, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. There was a man was shot and killed in North Philadelphia by a police officer responding to a call of a naked man standing in the street. And what happened is his sister unsuccessfully sued the city and the officer for excessive force. And the divided federal appeals court upheld the decision to dismiss the case. So we know how much in the forefront of the news these excessive force cases are, and you know what's happening in Charlotte now, and you know there is obviously a view among not only the black community but certain other people that the police are too quick to pull the trigger. And of course, from the other side, is at what point do you have to risk your life if you're a police officer? So it's not an easy decision. It's certainly difficult, and whether more training certainly should help. What is happening is that there are now more cameras, more people have more cell phones, and so what used to be hidden is now out there, and people are making their own decisions. So there was a case that might be interesting because it was a trial court awarded counsel fees against two pro se plaintiffs, meaning that these plaintiffs filed suits, and they did it themselves. They weren't represented by attorneys, but they did it. And they filed two complaints, and the pursuant to a statute. And the statute and the rule allows an award of counsel fees when a pleading filed by a non-prevailing party is frivolous. So in other words, it has to be the party who doesn't prevail, obviously, because it couldn't be frivolous if, in fact, somebody files a lawsuit and they prevail. But in this case, when the original complaint was dismissed by the court as lacking merit, the plaintiffs both filed a second complaint and an appeal. And so the appellate court concluded that the award of counsel fees was appropriate for filing the second complaint, but not for the first complaint. In other words, they said the first complaint was not frivolous or should not be considered frivolous, but the second one was. And so in this case, the appellate division explained the history of the frivolous pleading sanctions and the need to strictly construe the term frivolous to avoid litigants from becoming afraid to access the courts because of a fear that they may be sanctioned if they pursue a good faith but misconstrued claim. So this is really important. In this case, they would not have upheld the trial judge awarding counsel fees, except for the fact that the plaintiffs both filed a second complaint, and when that was dismissed, filed an appeal. Important case. So, you know, if you have an attorney or see attorneys, and if you have reputable attorneys telling you that, you know, you really don't have a bona fide complaint, listen. And certainly listen if a judge dismisses the complaint before you go and try to refile and then file an appeal. So it's difficult, extremely difficult to get legal fees under frivolous litigation. But it does happen, and here's an example. There's another, and that case was published. It's TAGAYUN versus AmeriChoice of New Jersey. It was published on September 20th or decided, I guess, approved for publication on September 20th. That means that we don't have the actual citation yet, and it takes a few weeks before that citation comes up. So there was also a approved for publication a decision with respect to motor vehicles, and in that case, the defendant was indicted on a single count of fourth-degree operating a motor vehicle during the period of license suspension for a second or subsequent conviction for driving while intoxicated. So he was indicted, meaning this is a criminal indictment, and that was for operating a motor vehicle during a period when his license was suspended for a second or subsequent conviction for driving while intoxicated, meaning that he'd had at least one prior DWI, DUI. And there is a specific statute that he was indicted for violating. So now in this case, the state appealed from an order of the trial court which admitted defendant into PTI over the prosecutor's veto. So what does that mean? In other words, the prosecutor said that they would not recommend PTI, which is pretrial intervention. And the trial judge allowed the defendant to go into pretrial intervention over the prosecutor's objection. So the prosecutor took the appeal. The appellate division reversed, and they ruled that the prosecutor's decision to reject the defendant's application for admission into PTI did not constitute a patent and a gross abuse of discretion as defined by the Supreme Court. In other words, that's the standard. The standard is that the prosecutor, it has to be patent and gross abuse of discretion. And there is, in fact, a case on that, a Supreme Court case. And, however, the court also rejected the prosecutor's characterization of the fourth degree offense as falling within the crimes that, by their very nature, carry a presumption against admission into PTI. So what does this mean? It means that a different prosecutor could have allowed the defendant to go into PTI, and the court would not have said that was wrong. In other words, the question here was whether or not the prosecutor was being reasonable and not a gross abuse of his discretion when, in this case, he said no. However, just because someone is indicted with a fourth degree operating a motor vehicle when the license is suspended, that's not an automatic crime, which by the nature carries a presumption against admission into PTI. So there are certain crimes that there's a presumption against PTI. Now, you can't murder somebody and then go say, oh, well, I just want to go into pretrial intervention. But this important case, because it just depended which side. Obviously the prosecutor would not have taken the appeal if he had agreed that the person went into PTI. And, of course, the defendant would not have taken an appeal either. So the issue is whether or not there was a gross abuse of the prosecutor's discretion. But again, it's a helpful case because any defense attorney knows that there's not automatically a disqualification of PTI if, in fact, someone is indicted for fourth degree operating a motor vehicle. I guess sometimes only those of us who are attorneys can find some of these things interesting. But certainly anybody who is driving on the revoke list and is, in fact, indicted would find that very important, and especially because they know that it's going to be up to the prosecutor as to whether or not they're allowed into PTI. And, of course, there'd be a lot of pressure on a prosecutor in a case like that, because assuming that they agree and allow the person into PTI, what happens if there's another DUI and, in fact, someone is hurt, injured, or even killed when it comes out that the person was permitted to go into the pretrial intervention program. Tough choices in those cases. So let me play a couple other spots and come back to wrap up the program for today.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
Hi, this is Ruth Ann Disatel, Celebrant Officiant with Celebration of a Lifetime. When people ask me why I joined the Chamber, it's because I want to get to know you and what you're all about. And I want you to get to know me and what I'm all about. And together, I'd like to celebrate what we can do for Hunterdon County.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Well, we're back for the last few minutes of the program, and there is a case that from the appellate division. This is a Supreme Court case, Huevas versus Wentworth Group, and the Supreme Court ruled that a judge should not rely on personal knowledge of other verdicts or comparative verdict methodology when deciding whether a motion for remittitor. Now, that means that whether the judge should decide based on the feel for the case whether to reduce a jury's damages award. So, in other words, they can't just, even if a jury awards what a judge feels is excessive, they can't just simply reduce it because their feel of the case based on their personal knowledge or other verdicts. And this case itself, in the Huevas case, the trial judge did not rely on personal knowledge of other verdicts or comparable verdicts presented by the parties in deciding the motion. Instead, she relied on the record before her. Therefore, the denial of remittitor conforms to the differential standard of review of a jury's award of damages. So in other words, there can be a question, and it will depend on what the judge did, or very often what the judge said in making the decision one way or the other, whether or not a jury's award should be reduced. Most of the cases are not published, meaning most of the decisions are not published. All of the decisions from the Supreme Court, the New Jersey Supreme Court, are published. Very few trial court judges' decisions are published, although it's a happy occurrence that a number of Judge Jones' decisions have in fact been published, and attorneys also read all of the, or most of us as attorneys will read all the cases, at least in the cases, for example, with me, I will read the family law cases because they can be very instructive even though they're not published. The problem is they can't be used as precedent, and that is problematic. But there was a case, a civil rights case, wrongful death, and against Franklin Township. And this is in the federal district court, and after a 10-year-old was struck and killed by a police car driven by a Franklin Township police officer. While the boy was crossing the street, his mother and his estate filed this action asserting claims against the police officer, against Franklin Township, against the county, the county prosecutor's office, and a specific prosecutor, Sean Dalton. And the court granted the county's motion to dismiss the claims against it. You know, based on certain cases, including, you know, situations of negligent training, finding many of the allegations lack sufficient factual support to raise the plaintiff's claims above the speculative level. However, the court granted them leave to amend their complaint to attempt to cure the pleading deficiencies. So what this sounds like to me is that the attorney who filed the pleadings, should have done a better job at filing the pleadings. So thereafter, the prosecutor's office and the prosecutor himself, the assistant prosecutor, moved to dismiss the claims against them for liability, both under the statute and individual liability. Now, the court granted the county's motion, finding that it was not a person capable of being sued under the statute, and it dismissed the claims against the individual prosecutor without prejudice, finding that the complaint had failed to plausibly allege dismissed the claim against the individual prosecutor without prejudice, meaning that it could be brought again, and that the finding, however, was that the complaint itself failed to plausibly allege his liability based on his failure to take safety precautions on the relevant roadway, and that the complaint failed to allege the theory plaintiffs asserted in opposition to the motion. And they also found that the document showed that the prosecutor had played a role, the assistant prosecutor had played a role in the making of practices and policies for the Franklin Township and for its police officers. And so, therefore, the plaintiffs were granted leave to amend their complaint to attempt to cure the pleading deficiencies as to the prosecutor. And I'm sorry, it was not the assistant prosecutor in the case. It was, in fact, the prosecutor. So that they were given a second or maybe third bite of the apple to try to cure what they were alleging to make this possible to proceed on their complaint. So I think that's pretty much what we have for today. And I think what we'll do is we'll go to the news and the weather, and then we'll be back with the sports guys. So hope you stay tuned, and hope to be here and see you next week. I think, again, I'll be talking about some general you know, just some general legal issues and cases. But in the meantime, hope you have a great weekend and enjoy it. And we'll be back with the sports guys shortly.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding